asked if he went to see the exhibition of Mark Rothko's paintings at Pace this fall. Good. I'm glad so many of you saw them. It's always been amazing to me that anybody could have thought those paintings express any kind of despair or depression. And happily, I had read Christopher's book, Mark Rothko from the Inside Out, before I went to that exhibition, which helped me appreciate it all the more. The first time I went, it was the day after the election. what an antidote to depression that exhibition was. But it was the second time that I went that I had a real insight or epiphany, because I stopped on the way at the Fashion Institute of Technology, where there was an exhibition of the clothes of the Comtesse Bacul, who was a great inspiration to Proust. And she, from the late 19th or early 20th centuries, dressed very sumptuously in Fortuny fabrics and other really gorgeous clothes. And there was a dress that particularly struck me. I don't look that carefully at dresses usually, at least in cases. But this one was black and violet and very highly pleated, so it was hard to tell where the violet ended and the black began. And then when I went a few blocks farther south to the Pace Gallery and saw the Rothko paintings again, I saw there was all the same fine texture of these vibrating colors with the same sumptuousness, lusciousness, and sensuousness that I saw on the dresses. And at that time, it was just about impossible to turn away from any one painting, to tear oneself away from any one painting to go on to the next. So now, tonight, we have the fortune of Christopher Rothko to tell us more about his father's entire painting career. Christopher got his BA at Yale in literature. He went on to the University of Michigan, where he got a PhD in psychology. He is, in fact, a clinical psychologist, which I'm sure helps him appreciate his father's art, and perhaps also gives him an understanding into the reactions of various people looking and writing about the art. He's also a classical music critic, and he has edited his father's own writings, The Artist's Realities, Philosophies of Art, which was published in 2004. This book, which is available outside, and Christopher will be glad to inscribe it for you afterwards, his book, Mark Rothko from the Inside Out. He's helped prepare more than 25 exhibitions on his father's work, and the next great one coming up will be at the National Gallery starting in 2019 of Rothko's works on paper. And finally, Christopher chairs the Rothko Chapel in Houston, which is dedicated to champion human rights and fostering interfaith understanding. So please welcome Christopher Rothko.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much to all of you for turning out tonight. What a lovely spot to speak. What a lovely fresh group of faces. So I'm looking forward to talking to you all a little bit about this book, and more specifically about my father's artwork. I'm going to start by giving just a little background on this book and the process that went into writing it. It's a collection of 18 pieces about my father that I've written over the past decade. But in fact, the ideas came to me really in just one moment in 2002. That night I had just this millisecond of direct connection to some muse somewhere, and it caused me to drop whatever it was I was holding and go fishing in the recycling for an envelope. I literally am a back of envelopes person. I have many of them to attest to this. And I scrambled for a pen, and I just started jotting down titles, and virtually all of those have eventually become the essays that are now in this book. Unfortunately, it took a really painfully long time to get those out. Life and a lot of Rothko exhibitions got in the way. And ironically, the thing that also pushed me to really get this book once and for all written, about 2-3 years ago, was the fact that I realized if I didn't get it written soon, it wouldn't be a book. It would just be some kind of electronic file that people would see on some kind of screen backlit device. And I don't know, I'm hoping that I have some sympathetic figures here, since we're in the Society Library, but I really like books. So that was also what really gave me the kick in the pants, because honestly, I wasn't any less busy 2 and 3 years ago than I am now or than I was 6 or 7 years ago. But I realized that I had to get these ideas down, and I want to get them out while somebody would make this beautiful object. So that is the reason that there is actually a book to talk about tonight. So this book, Mark Rothko from the Inside Out, is a product of roughly 25 years of daily hands-on work with my father's art. And it's given me, I think, really unique perspective on my father's work. That inside perspective stems from really concentrated, you would really almost say monomaniacal attention to Rothko and only to Rothko. And I will add Rothko from all periods, in all media, from the earliest figure sketches to some of the last abstractions and works on paper. I've seen nearly everything that he produced, and I evaluate each work not so much in the context of his contemporaries or in terms of the history of art, although he was very much a student of the history of art and passionate about many periods, particularly the Renaissance masters, Rembrandt's, Greek antiquity. But I don't really, that's not really my approach. My approach is that I really know exactly how his oeuvre unfolded. I know what came after each work, and I know how the periods evolved, and I can see what was something that was typical, what was a blind alley, and really understand the work in the context of his own oeuvre. At this point, I've really developed almost an instinctive understanding of the flow of the development and of his career, and I also have the benefit of a few family anecdotes, but also of having edited his book in philosophical writings, The Artist's Reality, and having that really quite deeply ingrained in my mind, having wrestled with this very much unfinished manuscript for really the better part of 2 years, it really gave me a very good bit of insight into what were the ideas behind the work. And you know, something he always emphasized, particularly as he was painting something very close to nothing, is that his works were absolutely not about nothing. They were filled with content, but it's really up to the viewer to help complete the specificity of that content. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that later on. So initially tonight, I plan to read from an essay that would have given you a broad overview of my father's career and how he developed as a communicator. But what fun is that, I thought? Particularly when I can talk to you about Rothko matters, it will take you deep, deep into the details, and deep with that, deep into my own complex and most darkest obsessions. Now, one of the mantras in the book is that with Rothko, the details really, really matter. And 45 minutes from now, when we're out the other side, I hope that you will agree with me that the details really matter, although there is the possibility that you just think I'm a bit deranged. And so it's in this spirit that I am going to present to you STAT, or at least what's left of it. Now, I had thought about making this just a one-sentence presentation, which would be something along the lines of never, ever use the forbidden word. But I'm afraid that the lure of verbal excess is really far too strong. And in the end, I think I'm going to succumb to some of my most un-Rothko-like urges. I'm going to speak to you in paragraphs where a simple statement would probably suffice. And I will probably explain several thoughts that don't really need explanation at all. But from my perspective, at least, the fact that this painting does not have stacked rectangles really should not need explanation. They simply are not stacked. And while this seems several orders of magnitude beyond self-evident to me, apparently it is not so for everyone. Even people with substantial grounding in the arts. And I'm going to divert you for a moment with a few statistics for all those people who just can't get away from mathematics. I did just a hasty bit of research in preparation for writing this essay and then updated it for the presentation. and I will tell you that there are, in fact, 119 instances of this descriptor in scholarly journals in reference to my father's work, 68 in published books, and 98 uses in that rapidly growing category of internet-based journalistic pieces, blogs, etc. Now, the real numbers of this for this, I assume, are at least twice as many, and at least from my perspective, clearly there's an epidemic afoot. And just so you know what Rothko is up against, I'll offer a small sampling of some of the choicer uses of this word by the various writers. First, there are those who cannot even recognize Rothko's preferred shape. They refer to the stacked block format, or stacked stripes and layered blocks, or stacked cubes, stacked fuzzy squares. And then there are those writers who intuit Rothko's forms and intuit that they really have no mass, but who then proceed to mass load them all the same by means of that word. For example, we find stacked weightless fields, stacks of color, stacks of ethereal hues, or my favorite, rectangles of disembodied color stacked one above another. These writers want to have it both ways, and much as they might wish it were so, you cannot stack a color. And finally, there are those who would keep Rothko's rectangles permanently earthbound. For example, two dark green rectangles stacked heavily over a smaller white rectangle, or rectangles placed one above the other in a tall and massive stack. All right, I think I've pumped this for all I can in terms of diversion and numbers, but over the next bit of our time together, I'm going to try to show you how each of these ways of characterizing the Rothko painting not only transforms me into a raving lunatic, but also to show how each of these usages undermines our appreciation of the expressive means and spirit in a Rothko painting. It's a lovely 1951 work that's in the National Gallery's collection. I used to hang in the deputy director's office. Nobody ever saw this painting unless you happened to be up in the offices. It's been out of it since. So let me begin, first of all, by apologizing to a number of academics, curators, and writers whom I respect, as well as countless art lovers, all of whom should ultimately be free to talk about painting any way they want. And I've been poking a bit of fun at them, and I'm certain that their use of the forbidden word was casual, a trifle careless, and surely nothing more. They do not spend all of their time preoccupied with one artist as I do. That said, at least two of the perpetrators were associated with Rothko for a significant portion of their career, and then there was a third whose time with Rothko's artwork was far briefer, but who left a significant mark on those statistics I quoted to you earlier. So possessed was he with an apparently incurable fondness for the term. So now that I've essentially taken back my apology, I must ask myself, why? Why am I so driven to distraction by this word? It's not simply that I focus excessively on details, although I guess it could be, if you ask all the project managers and registrars and art handlers I work with in preparing exhibitions. In fact, however, there are some reasons more grounded in reality that cause a hiccup in my reading every time I encounter the word, and that nearly provokes me to pen an admonishing letter to the author. I used to tell people that I'd actually written all these letters and I keep them in a file drawer somewhere just waiting for them, and it's not really true. What probably is true is I had more time than I really might have. Fortunately, I have a life. No, the real reason that I recoil from this word is solidly grounded in how we understand a Rothko painting, and in my endless quest to deflect those things that interfere with that process. And here I take up my lance because the concept of stacked is antithetical to how classic Rothko functions, how it is conceived, how it is composed, and how it interacts with the viewer. And not surprisingly, stacking is contrary to my father's philosophies on art, both in his writings and in their expression through his paintings. I will confess I'm tempted to simply continue griping about stacked. It's actually a great deal more fun than writing something constructive. But I'll keep my selfish desires in check, and instead, we're going to use the wrongheadedness of Stacked as a springboard for understanding my father's compositions more thoroughly. And I'm going to frame this by asking a few broad questions. First, how are the works constructed? And I'm going to note here that, constructed itself is a somewhat Stackian concept. Second, how and why does Rothko create his spatial effects? What are the roles of weight and physicality in the work? And finally, what does the concept of rectangles or flows bring to the work that Rectangle Stacked takes away? This painting, by the way, is a piece that my father painted for my sister. It was her 10th birthday present. It's signed for Kate on the back. It is, in fact, the only example I know of him dedicating the painting. We must examine a Rothko painting and observe how its rectangles relate to the rest of the piece. Now, I was tempted to speak of how the rectangles are arranged on the canvas, but again, arranged is moving us toward that physicality that Stacked imposes on the work. One does not need to look particularly carefully. The rectangles are not stacked. They simply are not. It's not an accurate description. It's not typical for Rothko's rectangles to touch, and rare for them to rest one upon another. But so what? Well, first of all, why not be accurate? But more critically, seeing the paintings as stacked distorts the means by which the paintings work. Stacking the rectangles imparts to them a succession of distinctly physical qualities that are not congruent with the way they operate in the painting or in Rothko's aesthetic. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary offers the following three definitions for stacked. Piled together, piled into a stack, piled with goods. Piled? This is hardly consonant with our experience of a Rothko painting, and it seems entirely at odds with laborious contemplation that was the hallmark of my father's process. This is probably the most famous photograph of my father, in part because it's the only one in color, or one of very few in color. But this was taken in the Hamptons. He spent, unlike most of his contemporaries, he spent only one summer in the Hamptons, and this was in a garage of a rented house. But he worked on a series of paintings in preparation for the Rothko Chapel in Houston that summer. But this moment in the Adirondack chair is actually very typical of his process, where he would paint something actually fairly rapidly, and then spend quite a bit of time looking at it, thinking about it, and trying to decide if it expressed accurately what he was trying to say, and reworking it if it didn't. So my problem again with this word is that there's a rough, haphazard quality imparted by this verb. An arbitrary approach to placement that is not in keeping with Rothko's meticulous attention to scale and apparent weighting in his composition. Piled, or indeed stacked, inelegant at best, sloppy to paint that inelegance in its true colors. One must not mistake the lack of surface perfection in my father's paintings for a lack of aesthetic criteria that was guiding their creation. One glance will reveal all the care that produces the balance of forms and colors that makes the works convincing wholes. What are the hallmarks of a classic Rothko painting? First, we must note that, with the exception of the Rothko Chapel-related works, my father's rectangles are never geometrical. They are softer, rounder, often unfinished rectangles. But if one stacks them, they become hard and foursquare, which conveys a very different sensibility. Second, Rothko's paintings are always hand-painted and feel that way. There's an overtly human quality to their rendering, one that makes them live and breathe, one that explicitly undercuts any severity in what might appear at first glance to be a modernist or minimalist style. Stacking the rectangles implies that one is working with something machined, with objects mass-produced and more or less identical. Objects that can be hoisted and set one upon another with a forklift, and I might add, then shrink-wrapped, palleted, and shipped cross-country. This is all per the dictionary definition of stacked, piled in a stack. Again, we may be tempted to say, so what? But we must remember that for Rothko, how the painting looks is not simply a matter of aesthetics. Beauty or harmony or balance is never an end in itself. Form always follows function for my father, not because he was an adherent of Bauhaus principles, but because the function of his painting is to express an idea, and his form is carefully crafted to maximize that idea's expression. Thus, when we are misperceiving his form, we are interfering with our own ability to have a powerful and concrete interaction with the work. And when we make the additional misstep of misrepresenting Rothko's forms in writing, we are visiting our misperception on others and distorting their understanding of the painting and how those paintings transmit their message. This is why I get so particular about this topic, and frankly vitriolic when those who should know better perpetuate this misconception of my father's work. And really just for fun, I commissioned an artist friend of mine recently to represent his notion of what stacks might look like as a composition. Not especially Rothko-like, is it? However Rothko's rectangles are made, and whatever their actual shape, when they're stacked, they become grounded, yoked to physicality from which my father worked hard to liberate them. They become decidedly material objects with palpable mass and ineluctable subjugation to gravity. Rothko paintings really do not need this. They are weighty enough in their own right, whether one is referring to the large scale, the deeply saturated colors, or the tragic content that speaks through them. There's already enough to keep the viewer rooted to one spot. To see the rectangles as stacked is to keep the painting stationary as well, and to miss precisely how my father has counterbalanced their apparent mass. By contrast, seeing Rothko's rectangles afloat undercuts their weight, imparting movement to the forms and loft to the shapes. It is Rothko's means of freeing them from the material world and giving them the expressive powers that function not just in compositional terms, but in philosophical, emotional, and perhaps spiritual terms as well. It is these qualities that remind us when we hear people say, oh, it's just a bunch of rectangles. It's these qualities that tell us that, in fact, it really is so much more. Even the sound of the word stacked, with its hard consonants, elicits a sense of corporal, physical properties that must be addressed. Items that are stacked must bear weight, as their weight in turn must be borne. They are inherently locked in a specific type of interdependence to which Rothko's rectangles are not subject. The forms of a classic Rothko are allowed to float free, their interaction with one another dictated neither by their own mass, nor by the mass of the other forms around them. This is critical, as my father creates energy, and usually, though not always, tension in the space between the rectangles. The ways in which he handles these areas, the interactions between colors, the appearance and disappearance of layers, the relative proximity of the rectangles to one another, each of these is an essential source of vitality for the painting. One can sense the electricity, the seemingly magnetic attraction and repulsion of the rectangles across these gaps, a magnetism that would be diffused if the rectangles were simply stacked one upon another. And I'm going to walk us through a series of classic Rothko paintings and talk a little bit about exactly this area. So this is a 1956 work, and that I hope people can see reasonably well. Can you see that there's a bluish band in between the dark black rectangle and the white one below? Mm-hmm. Now, at first it seems like something that he added to the gap, but if you look carefully, you can actually see that blue peeking out around the edges of the black rectangle. It's not actually something added, it's a layer underneath the entire painting that he allows to show through at that point. And if you observe that corona around that figure, around the black, you'll see it more easily. And this serves both to diffuse the interaction between the rectangles, but it also makes the interaction more complex. The rectangles are simultaneously in conversation with each other, but the blue is also there as an active observer, as an intermediary between them in that conversation. 1958 painting is in MoMA's collection. And here we see the spacing is wider and the rectangles look cleaner than in the previous work. They seem to float one above another, levitating and free to move differentially out from the picture plane. Observe how strongly the red pushes forward while the brown seems to recede. And I can promise you that if you see this painting purposed in person, yeah, the effect is much, much stronger. This 1961 painting is at the Hirschhorn Gallery in Washington and has a particularly concentrated energy across the gaps between particularly these lower two rectangles. This is one of those paintings where I see those meeting areas as a type of synapse, where a continual, almost chemical transmission takes place. And this effect is somewhat similar in this 1959 painting, which is actually on paper and is in my collection. And here the interaction is complicated a bit by the turbulence, both in the forms themselves and in the background. In addition, at the top of the painting, we find wisps of a black underlayer peeking out. And these inject themselves into the conversation between the upper rectangles, again, rendering that conversation more dynamic. But perhaps the most volatile is this 1954 canvas, where the roiling energy at the meeting points interferes with the initial impression of harmony and serenity. If you look at this detail, which is actually from the corner of the top rectangle, we can find that powerful osmotic process with layer after layer of color pushing through to add its input to the complex interaction. I've actually studied this painting very carefully. There are actually 11 layers of color making up the green rectangle. And those all shine through, and it's all part of how you experience the painting, and they all color certainly your emotional reaction. My father would certainly argue as well that they all add up to the complexity of the idea that he's trying to express. Thus, when we look at a Rothko painting, we can see that there is plasticity or flexibility to the way he manages the critical place, this critical place in his compositions. But there's also clear intentionality. He creates a compositional force that communicates unequivocally, not just rectangles. Now, contrast this sensibility with the rigidity inherent in items that are stacked. Nor is it only their physical properties. The nature of their interactions when stacked are unidimensional and unidirectional as well. This rigidity carries over to the way we see the rectangles themselves, solid and dense rather than filled with the dynamics of color and brush. Indeed, to perceive the rectangles as stacked renders them objects in a way that undercuts their very abstractness. They are locked into being one thing rather than something that can be many things, something with the power to suggest and to interact in myriad ways with myriad viewers. Stacking pushes the rectangles dangerously close to the role of representation, and it impedes their consolidation into Rothko's universal abstract language. That abstraction is at the very core of this communicative power. He fills his paintings with unshapes in an almost mystical space, sparking the viewer to imagine his way into the painting, to make his or her own sense of the world, of that world. Perhaps a world of concrete blocks has its own sense too, but it's certainly not Rothko's. Finally, I will reiterate that stacked communicates an air of casualness, of offhand arrangement that is completely at odds with Rothko's, if anything, overworked preoccupation with balance, proportion, and alignment. The simplicity of Rothko's work nearly obscures the artistry required to make such simplicity compelling. Limited material requires that those few materials interact with immediacy and by design. Stacking will not do. I've dissected, I believe, all the damaging distortions brought by that word, save for the most important. For if we see Rothko's rectangles as stacked, it interferes with the singular magic of the works. My father understood that the role of the artist is to take the familiar and transform it into something new, something unexpected, something that makes us look again and anew at what we thought we already understood. What could be more pedestrian than a rectangle? And what shape transcends the pedestrian origins to a greater degree than Rothko's rectangles? He turns the most ordinary building block into something that supersedes its form to function in many dimensions simultaneously. These are forms that aspire to the infinite, rectangles so transformed that they imbue us with those aspirations as well. No mean trick, but it cannot work when rectangles are stacked. They will just sit there. They will collapse back into simply being rectangles, and our vision collapses with them. The antidote to stacked, well, I've already mentioned it in passing, is to recognize that these rectangles float. By causing these rectangles to float, my father conjures something otherworldly from the ordinary. It is the compositional mechanism by which Rothko creates a Rothko. That float of the figures of these rectangles is what separates the classic works from the brilliantly colored multiforms that preceded them. And it's also what separates a great Rothko from a simply good one. For example, these are two paintings from virtually the same moments in the mid-1950s, but you can see that in terms of the composition, the way he handles the form, they could hardly be more different. And clearly, my father was experimenting with something, with a different, some type of additional, new type of compositional technique in his painting on the right, looking for maybe a new way to capture something that he's been exploring already. And he did consider this certainly a finished painting. And yet, I think for most of us, the painting on the left invites us into a world, invites us into a realm of possibilities to a far greater degree than the painting. I'm also going to show you a couple examples from the a little bit before in my father's career. This is one of these so-called multiform paintings. They never called them that, but they have come to be known that way. These were my father's first fully abstract works. He started painting them around 1946. And they are very colorful works. In fact, in many ways, his full color palette has been worked out at this point. He's making bold juxtapositions of sort of unexpected groups of colors that seem to somehow work together. There are many, many layers of colors that build up those colors. But the form itself has not really become cohesive in a way that is going to create a space where you have that sense of float and you have that sense of a painting that we can enter, of a space that invites us to imagine something beyond the picture. This next painting is almost there. This painting is somewhere between months and weeks before he starts painting Rothko's. It's actually the most borrowed painting in my collection, along with one other and one painting in my sister's collection, because there are really only six of these paintings where he has really started to bring the form together, stopped painting patches of color, but made it first into 12 rectangles, then 8 rectangles, and then 6 rectangles. And this painting is almost there. We're starting to see the form float a little bit, but he hasn't simplified to the point where, again, he is creating that world that is so suggestive, that is so inviting for us to really make our way into and start creating our own particular meaning in each of those paintings. But again, the color sense is there. He's going to be painting works in these salmons and yellows and bright oranges for the next 7 or 8 years, and you can see how many layers are building up those colors. So it was really just a question of form for him, and he continued to hone his form. As much as people think he sort of hit his formula and painted up for the last 20 years of his life, in fact, he's playing with it all the time. And in every single painting, you look at it, you can see where he's changed the proportions just a little bit to make that form, to make those rectangles float, and to make a form that really is as inviting and suggestive as possible. This painting from 1963 is really, I think, a prime example, and I'm going to return to this in a moment, but this is really a painting that is in a world unto itself. Now, for Rothko, not a new discovery. My sister and I understood this when I was a teenager and she was still in her 20s. As we went through dozens of paintings to determine which would grace the collection of the newly reconstituted Mark Rothko Foundation, which might come to us, and which the tax man would take away. And repeatedly, our choices revolved around what we called float. Some version of, well, the colors are beautiful, or bold, or stimulating, but not good float. That those words are something very much like them issued from our mouths repeatedly during that couple of months when we were making these selections. And today, our collections float very nicely, thank you very much. But ultimately, the tax man or the collectors who purchased on his behalf got some pretty good float, too. Now, float within a Rothko painting operates on a number of different planes. First, there's the float between the rectangles, the way they appear to levitate one above the other, that magnetic pulse between them that pushes them apart, not only lifting the upper rectangle, but seemingly reducing its mass as this outwardly weighty object hovers effortlessly above those below. Second, the rectangles float not only above one another, but also above the background. These most planar shapes creating in concert a palpable sense of three-dimensionality. The depth that my father creates in these two-dimensional works is uncanny, and in large part, what gives them their ethereal quality. And I want to pause for a moment and talk about this painting that I truly think is one of my father's masterpieces, and it's not terribly well known. It's in Bern, which I don't know how many of you have been to Bern. It's not even most people's first stop in Switzerland. And they almost never loan it because it's one of the best paintings in their collection. I, in fact, did not see it in person until 2008 when it was they were willing to pass it over the border to Hamburg. But it's one of his great paintings. And I'll talk you through some of those reasons. First of all, the interplay across the gap between the rectangles really is palpable. It's one of those places where, as I mentioned before, there's this kind of chemical exchange that goes on. Then there's a sense of movement within each rectangle, which I think is almost unequaled in this painting. That white cloud above is so alive and so inviting and so suggestive of places that you might go. And that's places you really might go, and it's also very much, be it a spiritual journey, be it an emotional journey, be it an intellectual journey, my father's inviting all of those things. The sense of space that he creates is really remarkable. The lower rectangle a little more contained, and the upper rectangle looks like it wants to float out of the picture frame. And honestly, I don't know how he does that. The colors are also sumptuous. It's a little hard to see here, but the background is really a very sensuous chocolate. I'd say about 72% cocoa for those of you church alcoholics in the house. And the paint he's thinned so much, it's essentially stained the canvas. You could really be mistaken for thinking the canvas was produced in that color. And the white is so complex, it feels like it contains all possible versions of white, and to me, all possible emotional states. And we're gathering all of this from a reproduction, and you can imagine how much stronger the impression is in the real painting. Now, as we can witness in this example, the background depths in a Rothko painting and the colors that float freely above them impart a searching or spiritual feeling to the work, a personal and psychological space not yet explored. It is a three-dimensional space born from the two dimensions that fail to contain it. A world compelling for its otherness, its reworking of how we thought things worked. This space is what makes a Rothko painting a world unto itself, an emotional world, a philosophical world, mirrored by the complexity that issues from the simplicity of the composition. Nor is that world static. The rectangles that appear to hang weightlessly are filled with their own sense of motion, most often expanding outward, at times falling inward, but always in dynamic interplay with the periphery of the painting. Stacked rectangles could have no such motion. They would be contained, married to their place in the pile. I will add that stacking is something that you do to a rectangle. float is something that rectangles do on their own. When a commentator stacks the rectangles, he or she is not really grounding them, but undermining the autonomy that is essential to their sense of motion and their ability to sidestep the Newtonian ground. There's great specificity in Rothko paintings, but it's a specificity that dwells quite comfortably in the company of ambiguity. My father painted his works with clear intent. It is an intent that you must discover experientially, one that you must make your own, rather than simply receive in the course of a lecture or treatise. The idea must have specificity for you, one that is born of your own internal processes, much as it was for Rothko. The space of a Rothko painting creates a realm not fully defined, one that allows for personally relevant meaning. It is a place and not, one that we must define by making sense of it for ourselves. Rothko's concrete shapes rendered ethereally, his two-dimensional space that blooms into three. These elements bring a particular tension and present a present-absent dichotomy, always in flux. His forms and also his paintings are both here and not here, real objects that elude their physical properties. He creates a thing in and of itself, not a depiction of another thing. And yet, that concrete object effectively melts away into a suggestion of someplace else. The invitation to look beyond is the product of float. It is implied, its implied movement and depth. Stacks cannot give us this space. It has no ambiguity. It is only here. By floating his rectangles, my father creates a physical object that defies its own physicality. On one level, it is magic, but is this not also a metaphor for our very humanity? The primary element my father insisted he was always trying to capture in his work. For it does not matter whether one looks east or west. All religions and philosophical traditions celebrate the ability of the mind and the soul to reach beyond the bounds of the body. This is our great human achievement, what separates us from other life forms. My father never spoke to this, so I cannot know the specifics of his beliefs on the transcendent. He was quite clear, however, that he looked to engage both our minds and our feeling states, our intellects and our preconscious minds. By doing so, he aimed to move his viewer out of the world of trivialities and into new realms of exploration. He certainly suggests what is possible and what is necessary by means of the images he creates. In this regard, my father's paintings put me in mind of the work of a sculptor I very much admire, Joel Shapiro. A lot of you will recognize this form. He had actually quite a large sculpture in more or less this style on the Met, or the roof of the Met, for several years. Shapiro's best-known works depict the human figure in blocky, stick-like forms. Elongated square section members are used to suggest both head and limbs, the compositions usually notable for their simplicity. Shapiro's materials are very material indeed, woods and metals that communicate mass and solidity, until they come together, that is. Then Shapiro's artistry animates them, bringing Pinocchio to life. He creates a remarkable sense of movement from an ostensibly static figure. As a result of that motion, the figure is transformed, and where there was weight, we now find remarkable lightness. Like my father's paintings, Shapiro's sculptures escape their physical parameters, finding movement where none should exist. In Shapiro's hands, we would dance in spite of ourselves. Both of these artists deal in potentialities, not so much what is, but what they come into being. Their works are essentially vessels for greater things that can be born from them. This is the beauty of their art, a beauty that draws on the human spirit, its ability to change and adapt and see what further change may come. Their work suggests there is something else, more than initial appearances and physical attributes. They invite us to engage with that dynamic, exploratory part of ourselves. If these two artists create a sense of transformation in their work, it is with the suggestion that we can do the same in ourselves and in the world. this final image, not simply because it's a particularly beautiful painting of my father's, a very, very late work, one of the last paintings he painted, but I put it up here simply to show an example where Rothko's rectangles do touch. And yet, I don't think there's any sense of being stacked. There's indeed remarkable lightness here. We've traveled a great distance from stacked, and perhaps that's the point. Stacked is static. If we were to have a transformative experience with art, we cannot let stacked and its relatives bound our horizons. Movement and change are essential. Just as artwork cannot be trapped in the confines of its material, we must be ready to move beyond the what is to the what could be. Can one little word interfere with that? You bet it can. Hence the motivation for what I'm ready to admit really began as a rather silly diatribe. But I believe in the magic of my father's work, its ability to move people as no collection of rectangles should. Yet I know that effect is fragile, and this is why so much of my work, and my sister's work as well, centers on preserving the right atmosphere in which to let that happen. It is clear to us that you cannot build a magic edifice from stacked rectangles. These rectangles must be left to float free in unexpected ways. At the time when I wrote this essay, there had been, to the best of my ability to ascertain the number, 285 uses of the word stacked applied in print to my father's rectangles. And if I achieve nothing else by publishing this book, then it is my dearest wish that 100 years from now, that number will still be 285. And while I am not sure that the mathematical relationship is linear, I would like to believe that a world where Rothko rectangles are no longer seen as stacked, that that is a world where the possibilities for understanding in new ways are also greater and freer to blossom. Thank you very much. I have another essay in the book called Mark Rothko and Music. My father's a great, great music lover. He imparted that to me. It was really his greatest gift to me. And he talked about trying to raise painting to the level of poignancy of music. And I talk a good deal in that essay about that. What do music and abstract art do? They express exactly the inexpressible. They express those things that can't be put into words. So I'm curious if there actually is a better word than both for this. But my sense is that still, it's not going to quite capture what the Rothko painting captures, because I think if he could have written it, he wouldn't have abandoned his book of philosophical writings and gone back to painting. He painted it because he realized he could capture that essence more in a painted work than he could in a written one.
Are not the words window or veil or view used in these terms, or is it always people using stacked in this?
oh no, people do talk, and actually in another essay I talk about the window metaphor, which is really something I should dislike, and I actually like it, but I they do sometimes look like windows, but I really feel like they're less windows for looking out, they're really more windows for looking in, you're gazing in and getting lost in parts of your own self.
But it's an open.
It is, well, yeah. Yes and no.
I was struck early in your presentation when you started to really accentuate the distinction from stacking to the other way of looking at the work in terms of dynamic interaction, something like that. What struck me was it sounds so similar to what happened in the field of psychology when we started to describe human behavior not in linear terms anymore, but in contextual terms, like in terms of relation to each other, rather than, you know, cause and effect. And it's sort of, it's interesting because I think it transcends art and psychology. It's part of what I think is the human way of understanding ourselves in a deeper way, spiritual or whatever. But the thing about psychology is that I find that just really striking.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really lovely thought, and certainly there's nothing that we do not in the context, the social context, and in the interpersonal context, and our own sort of interpsychic context, all those things interplay, so we never do anything in a vacuum. This is why, when I was trained, though, I was taught to believe there's no such thing as an accident. I'm not sure that that's really true, but the idea is that there's so many different things interacting and that are at the basis of behavior that you'd be surprised how many of them are active in any given thing that we do. So
let me add one thing to it. This is the first time I've ever really appreciated a lecture on art. And I'm not sure why, but I think it's because I have a sort of little paradigm shift around.
Yes,
could you address, or would you be interested in addressing the fact that the composition is usually vertical, not horizontal, and it seems to me there's a sense of rising. I don't know if that's appropriate.
So this has been discussed by many art historians, and something I take up as well at different points in the book. So first of all, the most typical size for a Rothko painting is somewhere between about 5'8" and 6'2". My father was 5'11". So, but they really, he wanted the paintings hung low. He wanted you to stare at the painting directly in the face, essentially. So there's something about that vertical form, although I'm not going to suggest for a minute that these are figures, and there are people who say, you know, feet, body, head. I don't buy that. But I do think that he's, it's another way that he emphasizes the humanity of what he's after. Now, traditionally in art historical terms, a painting that's taller than it is wide is a portrait, and one that is wider than it is tall is a landscape. And ironically, although as you're pointing out, most of your paintings are tall and they are wide, the fields themselves are wider than they are tall. Not always, but wider than they are tall. So he's painting landscapes within the context of a portrait. My real take on this, particularly because as you go into this later in his career in the 60s, the paintings get wider and wider, is he's actually trying to capture your field of vision. He's trying to make that interaction with the painting almost automatic, that these sort of fuzzy elliptical rectangles, he's replicating what you sort of see when you see the world. He's trying to basically have you walk into the painting and make that your whole world, your whole field of vision. And he does that more and more as he moves on his career.
It's interesting, the pastings of it, I took a picture of one of the big, large ones that is landscape with people sitting on a bench looking at it, so it's almost like a group.
Perfect.
Group portrait.
Yes?
There's something about your father's philosophy that you can share with us and inform his vision.
Well, what's interesting about his book of philosophical writings, it was written pretty early in his career, and he never mentions his own artwork. He never even mentions the fact that he's an artist. It's written very much from this sort of arm's length distance, which, and it's ironically he's writing it at all, because nobody knew his artwork at all at that point, and if they weren't buying his paintings, it's not clear why he thought anybody would read his book. But he does what he does in this period of 1935 to 41 when he's writing it, and from 40 to 41 he actually stops painting and just works on the book. He's also teaching, he's got a day job. He's really working out the questions that he's going to then work out and paint for the next 20 years. And if you read that book, you'll think he's talking about these paintings, when in fact he's painting figurative paintings and surrealist paintings while he's writing this book, because it's all about abstraction. It's all about the power of the abstract idea. It's all about the power of he sort of harkened back to this Greek time and even pre-Greek time when sort of religion and philosophy and medicine, all these great areas of learning were sort of one, and there's sort of this common understanding. He's trying to tap into that, this sort of more universal understanding. That's what he's trying to get at in the abstract language he also comes up with, to come to have something that nobody needs a lexicon to interact with, that they can interact with in hopefully the most natural of ways. Of course, it's proven that people see abstraction and they don't know what to do with it. But he trained me well enough that I see a lot of figurative painting and I don't know what to do with it. So. Yes? Unfortunately, my father died when I was 6 years old, so we did not talk about art very much, although we did talk about music a lot, I mean, really a lot, in those 6 years. But I don't think it would have necessarily unfolded any differently, because my sister's 13 years older than I am, or at least she was recently. I see she's getting younger, and I keep getting older, but she never had that conversation with him either. He really, he kept businessmen's hours. He would be in the studio from about 8 to 6 every day, come home, have dinner with the family, and he wasn't talking with art. But his artist friends, yes, he would chew the fat and talk about philosophy, art, what have you, far into the night. But I'm not sure I would have had that conversation. I didn't really understand a lot of what, I didn't really have that conversation until I edited that book. And then I had the conversation with him about his ideas about art. Other questions? Yes?
Yes. A couple of years ago, you were at the auction at Christie's. There was one of your father's paintings that was segregated by itself in a room with four white walls. Small room that they created to appreciate the painting, to enjoy the flow, as you say. And I thought it was very powerful to sit, and they put a bench in front of it. And it seemed to be such a good idea because it allowed that immersion and that privacy that you described. What is your reaction to that and the quote-unquote problem of seeing your father's work perhaps in a gallery with a room full of distraction?
Well, it's really what the last 14 years of his career were all pointed towards, is creating and actually getting quite obsessive about trying to control the experience for the viewer. So he is commissioned by to paint the murals for the Four Seasons Restaurant at the Siegel Building in 1957. And really from that commission on, he's thinking about almost all the time how we can create an atmosphere where he can have an extended conversation with the viewer. His part of the reason that I think his tonal palette darkens in those years, and starting with that Siegel commission, and if you've seen the play Red, those paintings, is because he realizes that he's going to have a slower conversation. He has to turn down the heat a little bit. He knows he's going to lose some viewers, but he needs to have something that's going to evolve more slowly at a time, over time, to seep into you. So, concurrent with that, there are collectors and museums that start creating Rothko rooms. The first is at the Phillips Collection in Washington. If any of you have been there, it's four Rothkos in a room. He worked very closely with Duncan Phillips, actually swapped out one painting to make a better quartet of works to really create a space where you could have that sort of immersive experience. He also was interviewed once and asked what his idea would be, and he said his idea would be to create little roadside chapels all across the country. It's like they say, little shacks by the side of the road. You could go in and, get out of your car and have an experience with the painting and have something more meaningful. This was might be because my father was one of the world's worst drivers. Any of us are alive is in part due to the fact that he eventually gave up driving. And stop making my mother trying to learn how to drive because that was also a disaster. But really, he was understanding that to have that moment of quiet is really, it's really his gift to the viewer, is to encourage you to have that moment. And the Rockdale Chapel was in Houston, which I hope some of you have been there. It's how I spend a lot of my life these days, is working on the Rockdale Chapel. We're actually renovating the skylight there to try to make it closer to what he imagined. Really create this space where you can really go in and be alone with the paintings, but really primarily alone with your thoughts and yourself. Yes? I think what's being referenced is that my father did commit suicide in 1970. The dark palette exhibition at the Pace Gallery this fall, one of the reasons I love this so much, and one of the reasons that Ani Glimcher was so intent on doing this exhibition, was to try and dispel the notion that my father's paintings grew darker because he was more and more depressed. There certainly was no question that he was depressed at the end of his life. But in fact, most of those dark paintings were painted long before he fell into that deep depression. And when he did, which followed an aneurysm he had in 1968 that nearly killed him, when he did, he came out of the hospital and was told by his doctor that he wasn't allowed to paint, which my father thought was the silliest thing he'd ever heard. And they finally compromised after quite an extended argument on he would paint only small works on paper, and he proceeded to produce more artwork in those 2 years when he was so terribly depressed, more artwork than he did in any other 2 year period in his life. So it's very interesting, and there are also the very, very dark works in that period, and they're very light works. As I said, this is one of the last, and actually is part of a series of which this is not one of the particularly lighter ones. So the bottom line is, There's no clear answer, but one of the things I do too in the book is try to discourage people from trying to look at the artwork through the backward lens of that telescope and interpret the art of like, oh, well, of course he killed himself, and therefore, because you don't live your life that way, and unfortunately he did battle depression at a couple of different points in his life, and it ultimately got the better of him in the end, but it doesn't mean that that's what the work is about.
One more question?
Yes.
You mentioned your sister a couple of times, your older sister. In fact, she also didn't have a conversation with your father about it afterwards. It sounds like when you went through the estate planning and you discussed it, your works, which the floating painting. Did she sort of agree with your 15, 20 years old?
It's actually remarkable how much my sister and I are think about the paintings in similar ways. And at this point, we've been working with the paintings so many years, we often don't even discuss it anymore. It's just sort of understood. But yes, I think we tend to have very similar opinions about which are the strongest paintings and why. What are the gems of the earlier periods that many people don't know, and we actually work quite hard to try and get those paintings out and about. Well, this is actually, I think, the only lecture that I give where I'm actually not showing quite a bit of the earlier work because it's a lot of it's magical and not simply as a precursor to what happens later, but in its own right. And I'm sure some of that similarity in how we approach it comes from the fact that I learned a lot about my father's painting from her. She grew up with it for a much longer time. It was always in the house. She was in the studio far more, and frankly, I wasn't even for 10 years after after he died, I wasn't really so conscious of what was really going on. So I'm sure she colored my worldview. It wasn't so terrible. So I think it's probably about time to stop, but I am here to sign books. I think I've been assigned that chair over there. Happy to describe it in any way you like, and happy to continue conversations. Thank you very much.